The time is now 6 p.m. Welcome to WORT's local news for Wednesday, April the 23rd, 2025. I'm your host, Robert McClure.
And I'm your host, Vicki Iden. In tonight's news, the new Wisconsin History Center breaks ground.
Changes to customer service at Social Security offices affects retirement benefits and more.
And in the second half, we'll recap why UW-Madison staff rallied last week, celebrate the birthday of Madison's longest-serving mayor, and broadcast the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves.
And every detail you've come to expect. So stay tuned, all these stories and more. But first, we'll go live to London for a bulletin of world news from the BBC.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. President Trump has accused Volodymyr Zelensky of harming peace negotiations after the Ukrainian leader said he could never recognize occupied Crimea as Russian territory. Speaking on Wednesday in the Oval Office, Mr. Trump said he thought a deal could be achieved soon.
I think Russia is ready, and a lot of people said Russia wanted to go for the whole thing. And I think we have a deal with Russia. We have to get a deal with Zelensky. And I hope that Zelensky, I thought it might be easier to deal with Zelensky. So far, it's been harder, but that's okay. It's all right. But I think we have a deal with both.
Our diplomatic correspondent is James Lundell.
This is two things. One, the Americans trying to put pressure on the Russians and the Ukrainians to move. One of the problems, I think, with all these negotiations, there haven't been any real hard deadlines. So to a certain extent, that's a sort of, you know, to try to generate some momentum in the negotiations. Also, I think it is just an expression of frustration. This is an administration that wants to move fast. It seems unaware that most peace talks and negotiations take months, if not years. It wants all of this sorted in weeks and is expressing its impatience.
Vatican police say St. Peter's Basilica will stay open all night so the large crowd outside can file past the coffin of Pope Francis. At midnight, when the church was supposed to close, there was still a long queue of people waiting to pay their respects. Some said they came in the late evening expecting a shorter wait, only to find the opposite. Delhi is closing its main border crossing with Pakistan in response to the killings of more than 20 of its citizens by Islamist separatists in Indian-administered Kashmir on Tuesday. All military advisers in Pakistan's High Commission in Delhi have been asked to leave within the week. A manhunt for the gunmen is continuing. Akib Chaya is a hotel owner in the region.
I just have two emotions at the moment. One is grief and the second is anger. We have been repeatedly telling the government since yesterday to give us some kind of a retaliation. The perpetrators need to be caught. They need to be brought to the books. They have killed our fellow countrymen. They have killed our Kashmiriyat, which we call. They have killed our hospitality. We are famous in the world for hospitality. They've also killed that.
A former U.S. Army intelligence analyst has been jailed for 7 years for passing sensitive defense information to China. Sergeant Corbin Schultz, who held a top secret security clearance, pleaded guilty. The U.S. Justice Department said he shared at least 92 classified military documents in exchange for $42,000. World News from the BBC. The authorities in Benin say Islamist insurgents killed 54 soldiers last week in an attack near the borders with Burkina Faso and Niger. It's the deadliest known attack since insurgents began operating in northern Benin at the beginning of the decade. Police in Brazil have launched an investigation into allegations that corrupt officials have siphoned off $1.1 billion in unauthorized deductions from pensions over the past 6 years. The head of the State Pension Institute and five other officials have been suspended. Federal police officers have served more than 200 search warrants across the country. Scientists believe bite marks found in the skeleton of a Roman gladiator are the first archaeological evidence of combat between a human and a lion. The remains were discovered in 2004 at a site in the north of England, believed to be the world's only well-preserved Roman gladiator cemetery. The scientists led the study said it was the first physical evidence of gladiators fighting big cats. 20 French pastry chefs say they've made the world's longest strawberry cake. Stretching nearly 122 metres and weighing more than a tonne, it took the chefs a week to construct, using 4,000 eggs and a truckload of sugar and cream. The gâteau was put on display at an ice rink in Paris before being cut up to feed visitors viewing the spectacle. Anouk de Thimery was the judge for Guinness World Records.
The main criteria for this record to be validated are that the final strawberry cake respects the traditional recipe, that it is composed of cream, strawberries and a biscuit base, and I also check that the overall result is uniform, that there is no separation between the different cakes.
BBC News.
Good evening, this is Rob McClure and Vicki Iden bringing you your local news live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. Here are the headlines for this evening.
For the second time, a federal judge has blocked the deportation of an international student at UW-Madison, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. U.S. District Judge William Conley issued a ruling yesterday stating that the Trump administration had wrongly revoked the student visa of Yue Yang, a student from China. Yang was not given an official reason for her visa being terminated, although she did get a speeding ticket in February. She pleaded no contest to that charge. And in his ruling delivered yesterday, Judge Conley rejected the speeding ticket infraction as a crime that would merit having her visa revoked. Judge Conley stopped the administration from deporting another international student last week, but his rulings protect only two of dozens of current students and recent UW alumni whose visas have been terminated this spring. Nationally, more than 1,000 international students have had their visas canceled by the Trump administration since the president's inauguration in January.
A bill that would extend Medicaid for postpartum mothers has advanced in the state Senate. The bill extends Medicaid for postpartum mothers from 60 days to a full year. It passed with near unanimous support and now awaits action from the Assembly. Wisconsin is one of just two states which have not expanded Medicaid coverage for postpartum mothers. Meanwhile, the State Assembly has advanced other bills seeking to expand requirements for collecting unemployment, reports the Wisconsin Examiner. One proposal would rebrand Wisconsin's unemployment system as, quote, re-employment assistance, and would expand the requirements for receiving aid. Another would prevent the use of tax money to create guaranteed income programs, which don't require some form of work or training. If approved, that could potentially affect Madison, which recently took part in an experimental year-long pilot program for guaranteed income. Milwaukee and Wausau have also explored similar programs.
The Trump administration is clamping down on Biden-era policies for student loan borrowers. The Department of Education announced at the start of the week that it would start collecting on student loan defaults in 2 weeks. That could impact more than 700,000 Wisconsin borrowers who hold more than $23 billion in collective student loan debt, and the majority of whom are between the ages of 25 and 49, reports the Wisconsin Public Radio. Garnishing wages will begin this summer, and intercepting tax refunds or Social Security payments may also be used to collect on the debts. This ends a five-year period where no student loan has been referred to collections. The moratorium has been in place since March of 2020, when federal student loan payments and collections were paused in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. That pause was extended multiple times since then, with the final grace period ending last fall.
Wisconsin is almost halfway to a decade-long goal to plant 100 million trees by the end of 2030, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. Governor Tony Evers announced the initiative 4 years ago on Earth Day, originally outlining a plan to plant 75 million trees. Last year, he upped the ante with an executive order pushing that total to 100 million. The Gov himself added to the tally yesterday, planting trees at an event in Governor Nelson State Park. That park is named for Governor Gaylord Nelson, who founded Earth Day 55 years ago yesterday.
With the Mifflin Street Block Party around the corner this Saturday, the Madison Police Department is introducing a new policy to encourage revelers to call for help if they need it. Under a new policy adopted yesterday, the MPD says it'll forego giving underage drinking citations if someone calls for help with a medical emergency. A similar policy has already been put in place by UW-Madison Campus Police. Last year, the annual spring bacchanal saw 80 arrests, mostly for underage drinking, and about two dozen people sent to the hospital or with a medical emergency.
And those were today's headlines. Now on to the rest of the day's top stories. In the humid morning air, people around Wisconsin came to the Capitol to lobby against a law that prohibits government contractors from actions known as BDS. Our reporter Dane Bulow has more.
Wisconsin's anti-BDS law comes in two parts. The first bars any governmental contractor in Wisconsin from boycotting, divesting, or putting sanctions on Israel. The second requires those potential contractors to pledge to that effect. If contractors are already engaging in prohibited boycott activities, they are barred from receiving governmental contracts over $100,000. Today, members of Wisconsin Coalition for Justice in Palestine and members of the Wisconsin Right to Boycott lobbied state legislature to repeal Wisconsin's anti-BDS laws. Sandy Pash is a former Democratic lawmaker who represented North Central Milwaukee County. She's one of the many lobbyists leading the charge to repeal the law.
Yeah, it takes away our right for free speech, and it has been used in other states as a door opening to add other amendments on to prevent people from boycotting things like fossil fuels or gun manufacturers or certain reproductive rights providers. So it's a very dangerous law that we have on our books.
The law was enacted in 2018. At the time, it received significant public testimony for and against. Those for the boycott ban argued that the boycotting was discriminatory, but it also questions Israel's legitimacy as a member of the international community. Those against it argued that BDS is a tool to peacefully protest against the conflict in Gaza, and that anti-boycott legislation would be a violation of the constitutional right to protest. Others argued that the bill makes no distinction between Israel and territory under Israeli jurisdiction. As of 2019, at least 17 other states have laws on the books that also target companies that boycott settlements, reports Human Rights Watch. Pash also took aim at the idea that the bill is anti-Semitic, as the bill received a diversity of perspectives from within the Jewish community. With lobbying and testimony from the Milwaukee Jewish Federation, which supported the bill, to Madison's J Street chapter, which opposed it.
I find it really reprehensible and unconscionable that in order for me to be able to serve women who are experiencing violence and are unsafe, that I am required to sign on to this contract and check off that I will not boycott Israel. What it's basically sets up a litmus test where you have to pledge allegiance to this foreign government in order to be able to do business in Wisconsin. And that really doesn't make any sense because we don't have this set up for any other country.
That was Janann Najib, the executive director of the Muslim Women's Coalition based out of Milwaukee. She says that Wisconsin's anti-BDS bill goes against her constitutional right to boycott, a long tradition in American history stretching back to the Boston Tea Party of 1773. Organizers affirmed that point, that the right to boycott is a form of expression protected by the First Amendment. They say that a 1982 Supreme Court ruling, which prevents governments from restricting or retaliating against people for their political beliefs or expressions, includes the right to boycott.
I think the most surprising thing for all of the folks that have been lobbying today, as they've been meeting with their legislators and their senators, is the fact that very few knew about this. And, you know, when you have a law and your legislature doesn't even know about it, that's problematic.
No bill has been introduced this session to repeal the law. For WORT News, I'm Dane Bulow.
The time is now 6:16, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
Just across the street from the state capitol, you might have noticed the demolition of the former Wisconsin Historical Museum. That's the site of the future Wisconsin History Center, which broke ground today, kicking off what's slated to be a 2-year construction project. WORT reporter Sutton Johnson was there.
And now let's celebrate this milestone, and together, let's build history. Let's build Wisconsin's new History Center. Thank you.
The future Wisconsin History Center will sit directly across from the state capitol, replacing the smaller and more muted State Historical Museum. When completed, it's expected to be around 100,000 square feet, with more than double the exhibit space of the old museum. Today, local and state politicians, along with leaders from the Ho-Chunk Nation, celebrated the launch. Instead of a traditional museum, the new project is described as a cultural hub with more room to preserve and present state history from a variety of perspectives. Here's John Greendeer, president of the Ho-Chunk Nation.
In order for us to actually be progressive, we have to kind of make sure that the history is told from our perspective. The best way to do that is to work in collaboration with the Wisconsin Historical Society to make sure that they are receiving accurate and authentic education.
The total cost for the project is expected to clock in at more than $160 million. More than two-thirds of that funding comes from public coffers. Christian Overland, director of the State Historical Society, outlined the many contributors who made this project possible.
The project is a shining example of a public partnership at its best. The state of Wisconsin provided the resources, and the legislature was gracious with their accountability too. Our private donors gave us the flexibility to dream big, to innovate, and to create something truly transformative. Our design partners, Continuum Architects and Planners, thank you for translating our shared vision into the immersive, engaging architectural and exhibition spaces you will see rise from this very ground.
Senator Mary Feltzkowski was especially optimistic about the museum's potential, highlighting the revenue it could provide from tourism and what it could teach its visitors.
It's going to bring people out, and it's going to bring them to the 12th Senate District. They're going to learn about that part of the state, and they're going to want to visit. They're going to bring their dollars up there. But it's also this center, the classroom experience that we're going to have. Students, they're going to be able to tap into all of the resources that are available in this building to learn about the state.
Construction is expected to be completed by spring 2027, with an opening slated for that fall. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Sutton Johnson.
It's now 6:19 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
if you're of a certain age and just finished a lifetime of work, you might be ready to collect your Social Security benefits. But you should know that doing so by phone is no longer an option after a controversial policy change that went into effect last week. The Social Security Agency's staff is helping Americans navigate the change as they grapple with nationwide staffing cuts and office closures as well. Our producer, Faye Parks, headed to the Madison Office of Social Security this afternoon to see how they're faring.
The Social Security Office on Madison's west side is set up like a DMV. It has a small waiting area, three windows where folks can speak with staff, even a stand where people take a number to grab a spot in line, and two small framed portraits of the president and vice president hanging in the corner of the room. There was a steady stream of people there this afternoon, with the windows constantly occupied and at least three people waiting their turn. Most of the folks I met declined an interview, but I convinced Mike Padroot to step outside and answer a few of my questions. He was there today to drop off his application for Medicare Part B, as he'll qualify for benefits next month. Padroot would have finished applying earlier, but he says he mistakenly applied for Part A the first go-around. He called yesterday to get advice and was stuck on hold for hours.
Kept playing messages over and over again, and then they would play some music. Eventually, it was about 2 hours. The person came on, very friendly, very helpful, you know, answered my questions, just told me that I needed to get this form filled out. It was actually a Part B Medicare application form that I needed to fill some things out. My former employee needed to fill some things out, and then I needed to mail it back in. Because I'm on a time restraint, I decided to bring it in and drop it off at the office today and avoid the delay in the mailing process.
When Padroot called for assistance last month, he says the wait wasn't as bad. But that was before the Social Security Administration announced a policy change that brought on a deluge of calls and crashed their system numerous times. More than 4 in 10 retirees apply for their Social Security benefits by phone. That's according to a new analysis from progressive think tank Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. But under the new policy enacted last week, you can now only apply in person or online. The same restrictions apply to those seeking survivor benefits or changes to the direct deposit account. Social Security higher-ups announced the change late last month. Jessica LaPointe works as a claims specialist at the Social Security office in Madison. She says the agency's staff found out at the same time as the public, via press release and a post on X.
We demanded answers. Nobody had any in terms of the agency. About 3 to 4 days after they notified the public through press release, the manager started to informally notify the workers, but had no information. It seems like they were left in the dark as well.
The agency changed the policy several times in the following weeks, responding to pushback from the public and from Congress.
And there was a lot of chaos and confusion and uncertainty that led to a very stressed out workforce, leaving the American public out to dry. I mean, we had lines in Madison out the door and around the corner of people just bringing in their ID because they thought that their benefits were going to get cut off. They just really didn't understand what the changes were and how it would affect them.
SSA higher-ups ultimately stuck to their guns and moved forward with the policy change. It was implemented on Monday, April 14th, and staff were notified just 3 days before that, on a Friday.
We had about 3 hours or so to get certified that we took a 13-minute training video. Weren't able to interact and ask questions. We had to squeeze it in between interviewing the public, digest it, and then be ready to go by Monday. So we finally got the training. We understood a little bit of the impact, and now we're just working to play catch up on all those workloads of people just having us photocopy their ID and figuring out sort of what to do with the changes moving forward, and it's all still new.
LaPointe says the most vulnerable Americans will take the brunt of the consequences under the policy change. Disabled and elderly Americans will have to access the internet when they may not have the knowledge or means to do so, or travel sometimes hours away to their nearest Social Security office. On top of that, she adds, their system keeps crashing.
So if you know how to use the internet, if you have the technology and the means to get on the internet, there's no guarantee that the system is going to work properly for you to be able to access it.
further complicating the issue. The Social Security Administration is at a 50-year low in staffing, and DOGE is pushing for even more cuts. Understaffing is leading to significant delays.
It takes months to get a retirement application, an appointment set up, months to get it processed. It takes over 8 months to get an initial disability decision once you've been able to get an appointment. So overall, taking over a year or more. It takes 3 years to get through the hearing level. It takes hours, if not days, to get through on the 1-800 number. So all of that is just going to get worse as we're losing our staff. 40 offices lost 25% of their staff around the country. And then they're creating these policies that make it harder and harder for the American people to access their benefits once they can get through.
Jessica LaPointe isn't just a Social Security employee. She's also president of the American Federation of Government Employees, Council 220, and the union steward at the Madison Social Security office.
We are litigating everything that we can. We're litigating the repudiation of our contract on all fronts in terms of return to office mandates, 5-point emails, the reorganization, the end of our civil rights department, and multiple attacks on workers. Everything is on the table for litigation that we're pursuing, but then we're also communicating with the American people because they need to decide, they need to have the information, the correct information, and decide how badly they want to fight for their earned Social Security program and benefits.
But it doesn't look like the service delays will improve anytime soon. Mike Padroot has a word of advice for people planning on applying for benefits.
Well, I would say start the process as early as you can. You know, you can 3 months before the month of your birthday, and I started, you know, 2 months beforehand. If everything goes smooth, you're fine. But if you have a glitch, I'm pushing it right now because I only have a few days before I need to get my application in. So I would start as early as you possibly can with the process.
For WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
You're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Stay with us. We've got a lot more stories for you coming up in the second half of the show. We'll learn how UW-Madison student journalists covered last week's staff rally. Longtime former mayor Paul Soglin turns 80. And, of course, every last detail about the weather over the coming 5 days.
Well, first we'll take a quick break and check back in with the BBC for a bulletin of news from around the world. Stay tuned.
Literacy Network invites you to join them as they celebrate adults reaching their goals through free adult literacy education at their annual Reading Between the Lines fundraiser. From 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. on Thursday, April 24th at the Black Business Hub, you can enjoy wine tasting, hors d'oeuvres from student-owned restaurants, live mariachi, and a program that features stories from Literacy Network students and supporters, including community leader Joanne Burrish telling her own immigrant story. All proceeds benefit Literacy Network students working toward their dreams and goals, including becoming U.S. citizens, earning their GEDs, securing job opportunities, and more. Registration information for this event is available at litnetwork.org/RBTW2025. Deadline to register is Sunday, April 20th.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
BBC News. President Trump has accused Volodymyr Zelensky of harming peace negotiations after the Ukrainian leader said he would never recognize Russian sovereignty over Crimea. The U.S. is pressing for a deal that would see Russia keep much of the territory it has seized. Ukraine wants a full ceasefire before final terms are discussed. St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican is to stay open all night, so the large crowd gathered outside can file past the coffin of Pope Francis. At midnight, when the church was supposed to close, there was still a long queue of people waiting to pay their respects. India is closing its main border crossing with Pakistan in response to the killing of 26 tourists by Islamist separatists in Kashmir. It's also expelling some diplomats, revoking certain visas, and suspending a water-sharing treaty. The US Treasury Secretary has urged the World Bank and the IMF to return to their core mission of boosting economic growth and financial stability. Scott Bessent accused the institutions of focusing too much on issues like climate and gender. A former U.S. Army intelligence analyst has been jailed for 7 years for passing sensitive defense information to China. Sergeant Corbin Schultz pleaded guilty. The head of Brazil's State Pension Institute has been sacked after being accused of involvement in a scheme that defrauded pensioners of more than $1 billion. Alessandro Stefanuto denies any wrongdoing. Wounds on the skeleton of a Roman gladiator found in northern England have been confirmed as bite marks from a lion. Combat between humans and big cats is a well-documented feature of ancient Rome, but this is the first archaeological evidence. BBC News.
Time is now 6:32, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. Thanks for staying with us.
Up next is Cardinal Call, our weekly segment featuring news from the UW-Madison campus. Today, host Ted Hingstrom sits down with the Daily Cardinal copy chiefs, Clara Strecker and Zoe Elwood, to discuss their reporting on last Thursday's university staff protest, where they condemned Donald Trump's attacks on higher education and demanded support for UW's international students.
Hello and welcome to Cardinal Call, your biweekly dose of news from UW-Madison's own Daily Cardinal student newspaper. We are your hosts, Oliver Gerhars
and Ted Hingstrom.
Since the beginning of Donald Trump's second presidential term, protests and opposition have rocked the nation. In Madison, the phenomena is no different. Over 100 University of Wisconsin faculty members, teaching assistants, and activists rallied last Thursday at Library Mall in opposition of the American president's attacks on higher education. Today, we're joined by Daily Cardinal copy chiefs Zoe Elwood and Clara Strecker to discuss their reporting on the gathering. Welcome to the segment.
Thank you for having us.
Your reporting mentions steps the Trump administration has taken to weaken higher education that prompted the protests to take place. Could you provide some background on these?
People are saying that higher education is under attack because of budget cuts and student visa terminations. The Trump administration has already cut $12.6 million in research funding at the University of Wisconsin, Madison. And the Trump administration has also terminated at least 27 visas, including student visas and alumni visa employee extensions.
Recently, University of Wisconsin Chancellor Jennifer Mnuchin wrote an op-ed in the Wisconsin State Journal defending international students in the UW community. What have UW faculty and staff been saying in regards to what the Trump administration has been doing?
Yeah, so I know that, like, after speaking with a couple of professors and, like, assistant professors at the rallies, their main concern is, like, the future of free speech for their students. And I know Lucas Graves specifically, who's a journalism professor at Madison, he, like, had stated that these terminations, like, the visa terminations across the nation are politically motivated, quote-unquote, and that it's a critical moment for protecting the academic freedom of all these students across the nation. And then, like, regarding the statement that Mnookin made, I know that we talked to the dean what she thought about the statement, but she had said that she hadn't read it at the time. I'm sure she has now. And then there's just, like, also a main point about solidarity and then coming together to protect the students and protect free speech and the right to protest.
What are some of the demands the protesters are calling for, and what impact would they have on the university?
So there are two main demands that they are calling for. First, they're calling for a quote-unquote meet and confer relationship, which basically means that they want to have conversations between the unions, like the TAA, which is the Teacher Assistance Association, and the chancellors, and work on conditions for laborers and issues in faculty members, which have previously been pushed for months but are now more heightened due to recent events. The second main demand that they're calling for is they want the University of Wisconsin to join the Big Ten Mutual Defense Compact, which basically is for Big Ten schools to pool money for a shared defense fund. They are also calling for more transparency from officials and administration regarding with their cooperation with ICE or non-cooperation with ICE.
In your experience reporting on this subject, why is it important to fund higher education?
So reporting on this topic is actually fairly new for all of us, like all of the people are part of the story. But I know, like, from reading, like, past coverage on this type of stuff, or recent coverage, actually, I should say. But I know, like, a quote specifically from, like, Jay Rothman, who's, like, the president of the UW system. He had, like, said that these cuts on research labs could affect, like, potentially life-saving research for families that they count on. So, and then also it would affect the studies on, like, COVID vaccine development and virus replication, and other cuts could affect mental health research. So just, like, affecting that group of people is a big deal, and I know people are very concerned about that.
And do you think anything could come out of these protests?
Obviously, having protests raises awareness about the issues, and also having a lot of TAs and faculty members there brings that to light from the faculty perspective and not just students protesting or other organizations protesting.
Was there anything else you wanted to include for this story but decided to keep out of the final cut?
I know this specific protest, we got a lot of sourcing from a lot of community members, but specifically I remember I talked a lot with the co-director for the TAA, Daniel Levitin, and he just, like, he also was a speaker at the protest, but he was just very passionate about freedom of speech and all of that. And then I know everyone else in the crowd, just community members, were also there just to support faculty and support these students and these visa terminations and trying to, like, put an end to all these cuts.
Zoe and Clara, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
In campus news, Wall Street Journal columnist Jason Gay to deliver spring 2025 commencement address. The class of 1992 University of Wisconsin alum covers sports and culture in his column for the Wall Street Journal. In a press release, UW-Madison Chancellor Jennifer Mnookin said, quote, "We're thrilled that he'll be returning to campus to celebrate our 2025 graduates and to share the wisdom he's picked up along his career path," unquote. And in other campus news, Department of Education to begin collecting defaulted federal student loans again in 2 weeks. In a press release, the department cast the decision as aiming to protect, quote, responsible taxpayers, unquote, from shouldering the burden of those who took out loans to pay for school. The move affects at least 5 million borrowers and ends a 5-year pause that began during the pandemic. The department said it would begin collecting loans on May 5th.
That's all for the Cardinal Call this week. We've been your hosts, Oliver Gerhars
and Ted Hingstrom. You can find more news and stories from UW-Madison's student journalists at dailycardinal.com.
Thank you.
It's now 6:40 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. It's time now for the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves with WORT weather expert Rob McClure.
Well, occasionally I'm delighted to be wrong, and that was certainly the case yesterday and today when my forecast for Monday morning turned up, a good 10 degrees too cool yesterday. We had 69 instead of the upper 50s, as I'd predicted, and then we hit 71 today when I had advertised something more like the mid-60s, so several degrees there as well. So pessimism does sometimes pay off. I'm sure if I had predicted 71 today, we'd never have come close. Part of the reason for the divergence between prediction and reality has to do with cloud cover, which relinquished its grip enough both of those days after morning showers to give the late April sun, which is as high in the sky as it is in mid-August this time of year, letting it really go to work on the low-level air mass. And I should say as well, the low-level air mass did modify more than I was expecting. With the passing upper ridge and southerly winds these past 36 hours. So again, very happy to have been wrong on that score as well. With a roughly west-east frontal boundary kind of bobbing north and south across the area over the coming days, underneath a roughly parallel set of upper winds above, cloud cover and continued changes of wind direction and air mass are going to continue to be hazards in making accurate predictions going forward. If you have a look at the water vapor image of the contiguous U.S. from the GOES-East satellite that we have linked on the WORT weather webpage this evening, you'll see over the past 3 days of the image loop there, the transition from a very amplified upper air pattern that was over the U.S. this past weekend and Monday, starting to become predominantly a zonal pattern, beginning with yesterday, with a jet stream streaking now eastward across about the 40th parallel, with the shallow waves ensuing, primarily lifting the jet northward and producing an elongated but kind of flat upper ridge that stretches currently from about southern Montana to the northern Great Lakes. A decent amount of warm air and some moisture as well has flowed northward up under that ridge, as you can tell from stepping outside. Have a look at the visible satellite image of the upper Midwest, which we also have linked on the WORT weather webpage down below a little bit. And you'll see that that warm air stops at a frontal boundary that's visible in the surface streamlines on that image, which stretches from about Omaha east-northeastward up into central Wisconsin. That's currently a cold front, and it's incoming, and that may yet set off some showers and thunderstorms this evening as it sags southeastward over us. Though so far, the cumulus clouds that are popping up ahead of that feature out over Iowa do look quiescent. The low-level boundary may yet work north back over us again tomorrow, though it's also likely to interact to some extent with the colder air that's sitting over Lake Michigan to our east. So that's going to complicate temperature predictions for tomorrow with what will be likely a fairly good bit of variation from west to east. A stronger upper wave proceeding eastward tomorrow night across the region will probably induce a surge of moisture from the south up and over the sloping frontal surface that will be overhead here. So that'll bring a fairly good likelihood of showers and possibly a thunderstorm or two overnight into Friday morning. And after that, a more robust surface air mass pushing southward out of southern Canada will send the frontal boundary and its moisture well down into the lower Ohio Valley. So that'll dry and clear us for the better part of the weekend. But resurgent warm air and upper ridging will reclaim the upper Midwest as we get out into the early days of next week, and possibly with our first 80-degree temperature. Also possibly with a chance of severe thunderstorms. The Storm Prediction Center, which follows severe weather, already has the area outlooked for a possible risk in its 5- and 6-day outlooks. You can view those also from the WORT weather webpage where we have links. In the nearer term, though, severe weather is looking less likely for this evening, given the lack of development to our west, as I mentioned so far. We do have a decent bit of veering directional and speed shear in the air column above us, so any storms that might still get going could be well organized. But otherwise, I think skies will just see an increase in passing cloud cover from storms to our southwest, with southerly winds at 3 to 7 miles per hour veering lightly northward towards midnight. Temperatures will drop to the low to mid-50s. Once again, kind of a tough call in terms of sky cover tomorrow, but I'm expecting more high and mid-level clouds than today, and with possible lower cloud cover as well, at least through parts of the day. Winds will be east-southeasterly in areas, especially from Madison eastward, and that'll have a cooling effect generally on the temperatures. Out in, say, Lafayette and Iowa and Richland counties, it's possible the winds may back enough southerly in the afternoon at 5 to 10 miles per hour to possibly take the temperatures to 70 or better, while areas further east hold in somewhere in the mid-60s. Showers and thunderstorms become more likely as we get into the overnight and especially past midnight tomorrow night into Friday morning. Temperatures will drop to about 50 or so, or perhaps the upper 40s, as more easterly winds push across all areas at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Precipitation will be slow to clear east and southeast of us on Friday, but most areas, I think, will dry out by the late morning or afternoon hours, earlier to the west and north, later to the south and east, with clouds lifting slowly thereafter. Pardon me. Temperatures will progress little past the low and mid-50s on Friday on northeasterly winds up at 10 to 15 miles per hour, backing more northerly through the day. Skies will become clearer as we get into the overnight hours and drier air works in over us from the north. Temperatures will drop to the upper 30s to around 40 during that overnight. And Saturday should see a good bit of sunshine, hopefully returning the temperatures perhaps to 60, if not very close. Though north and northeasterly winds at 5 to 10 miles per hour will not help with any warming that day. Winds will continue to veer east and southeast, though, as we go overnight. And if southerly winds can come up enough on Sunday, we may make it back to the upper 60s, though we're likely to see some increasing high clouds later in the day start cascading through the skies. At the station down here on Bedford Street currently, the temperature is 69 degrees. The dew point temperature is 53. Winds are out of the south at 6 miles per hour, passing Alta Cumulus up at about 14,000 feet last I looked out the window. And the barometer's at 30.06 inches of mercury currently and falling slowly. The time is now 6:48 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news with Rob McClure and Vicki Iden on WORT.
We go now to a special edition of Madison in the 60s, marking former Mayor Paul Soglin's 80th birthday this week. Here's Stu Levitan to survey his personal background and political legacy.
Madison in the 60s and 70s. Mayor Paul Soglin. Part 1. Paul Richard Soglin was born and bred to be a radical, and no Madison mayor to date has had a greater or more progressive impact than he did in the first of his three administrations, 1973 to 1979, particularly in his first two-year term. The Madison Civic Center, State Street Mall and Capitol Concourse, a successful bond issue for a downtown Madison-area technical college campus, an improved bus system, groundbreaking programs for childcare and other human services, adding sexual orientation to the Equal Opportunities Ordinance, financial disclosure for city officials, public housing for families, the elderly and handicapped, helping block a nuclear power plant on nearby Lake Koshkonong, appointments to city boards and commissions of unprecedented diversity, new commissions on the environment, transportation, youth, cultural affairs, and people with disabilities, aggressive prosecution of landlords for building code violations, a citizens' committee to review police policies, the pedestrian bicycle path on John Nolan Drive, even a ban on the sale of handguns. All done, built, or begun the 2 years after he took office, April 18, 1973. His Jewish-Polish heritage made Soglin unique among Madison mayors and foreshadowed his political activism. His maternal grandfather, who emigrated to New York in 1905, was a communist revolutionary. His paternal grandfather, who came to Chicago in 1912, had lived under an assumed name to avoid the Tsar's draft. His father, who had attained high-level security clearance training GI radio operators during World War II, lost his clearance after the war, so he took to teaching in the Chicago public schools. He taught without pay for 2 years after he refused to sign a mandatory loyalty oath in 1955. His mother, who named him Paul R. in honor of the majestic black entertainer-activist athlete Paul Robeson, took him to a nuclear disarmament demonstration when he was 4. He was 12 when his name first appeared in an FBI report on his parents. Raised in the Kenwood Hyde Park and Highland Park neighborhoods, his first independent political act was picketing the Chicago Woolworths to support Southern lunch counter segregation in February 1960. Later that year, his final address in speech class was supporting the recent Cuban Revolution. Given his family history, Soglin naturally looked for a university where he wouldn't ever have to wear a uniform or take orders, such as the University of Wisconsin, whose regents had in 1960 abolished mandatory ROTC. Soglin entered in September 1962 and within months was an officer of the civil rights group UW Friends of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. In October 1963, he was in the small crowd at the Memorial Union holding the first rally against the war in Vietnam. His pre-med grades did not keep pace with his activism, and he barely avoided flunking out in his first 2 years. After switching his focus to history, studying with such legendary professors as George Mossy, Harvey Goldberg, William Appleman Williams, and Stanley Cutler, he graduated with honors. Living in the Mifflin neighborhood as a senior, 1965-66, he won a close election to the Wisconsin Student Association Senate after one of the two other candidates was disqualified, and again as a history graduate student in November 1966. He resigned in early 1967 to focus on campus community relations, later becoming a columnist for the Daily Cardinal, where he penned a perceptive prediction that anti-war protests would overwhelm the new chancellor, William Sewell. Soglin joined the anti-draft sit-in at the administration building in May 1966, the Bascom Hall sit-in over Dow in February 1967, and the University Avenue sit-in over the wrong-way bus lane later that May, his first of three arrests. He was an activist, but wasn't seen as having the intellectual or emotional firepower of the real leaders. It was the Battle of Dow on October 18, 1967, where he was pummeled by baton-wielding officers that helped push him to greater prominence. Soglin had had virtually nothing to do with planning the two-pronged protest, but in the immediate aftermath, as organizers scattered or were suspended, a leadership vacuum developed, and the next morning he chaired the newly formed Committee for Student Rights Library Mall rally of about 2,000. As the broader Madison community yearned to learn more about the anti-war movement and why local police were the first in the country to use tear gas to quell an on-campus demonstration, Soglin led the charge off campus. In March 1968, he was the student on a panel on student rights on the far north side, along with Republican attorney Bill Dyke, the man Soglin would unseat as mayor just 5 years later. In April 1968, Soglin defeated the six-term 8th Ward incumbent Alder Ellsworth Swenson. Already a member of the National Supervisory Board of the National Student Association, that election cost him the NSA presidency in August, because he would not resign from the council and move to Washington, D.C. As one of the first young radicals to successfully enter electoral politics, Soglin got national press attention. After just 1 year on the council, he was profiled as, quote, the boy alderman of Madison in Look magazine. The five-page feature reported he was, quote, one of the more effective of the city council, working hard and applying his scholar's mind to his work. He first ran for mayor in 1971, finishing a respectable third in the primary behind Council President Alder Leo Cooper, a progressive railroad switchman, and the arch-conservative incumbent, Mayor William Dyke, comfortably re-elected in April. 2 years later, Soglin survived a tough primary with Cooper and UW Administrator David Stewart for the chance to face Dyke. 5 months after McGovern took on Nixon, Madison would have a municipal replay, with a far different result. Out-hustled and out-organized, Dyke in the last week ensured his defeat in the campaign's one joint appearance, declaring to a West High School audience that, quote, I have enough faith in the decent people of this city that you'll make the right choice. But the people, both decent and not, had a different idea of what the right choice was. In a record turnout election on April 3, 1973, Soglin ran up unimaginable margins downtown, winning citywide by more than 3,000 votes, about 5%. He was 3 weeks shy of turning 28, likely the youngest person ever elected to lead so large an American city, and the national press again took note. Dyke declined Soglin's request to meet before the transition and did not attend his swearing-in. And that's our 80th birthday special on Mayor Paul Soglin, Part 1. For your award-winning, listener-supported WORT News team, I'm Stu Levitan.
And that does it for our show this evening. Thanks for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Our headline writers this evening were Greg Sanderson and Jack Goodman. Sutton Johnson and Dane Bula were our reporters. Special thanks to our feature contributors, Oliver Gerhards, Ted Hingstrom, and Stu Levitan. Katie Gergella is our on-air engineer on Wednesdays. Bay Parks produced the newscast, and Shelley Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure.
And I'm your host, Vicki Iden. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is Query, followed by This Way Out. Good night.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. Yay!
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for two open participating member seats and one open listener sponsor seat to serve three-year terms on the Board of Directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2028. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Thursday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 29th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 29th. More information and board applications are available at wardfm.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.